Writers Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to James Howard Kunstler, specifically about two of his many books. We're talking about A World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, David?
Good. Now, you know, the first thing I guess we should talk about is the fact that these are novels, and whereas I think, you know, many readers will know of you through your nonfiction work, particularly The Long Emergency, which came out a few years ago. And maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of where these books fit in into your, you know, your thinking and your creativity and your art.
Well, it actually goes back a ways. In 1993, I published a book called The Geography of Nowhere, and it was about the suburban fiasco and how it came about and what it portended for the future. And in that book, it was quite a while ago, but one couldn't fail to notice that we were heading into some kind of a problem with our fuel supply, with the, you know, the oil that we use to run this highly suburbanized society. And, you know, I wrote a bunch of other books about cities and suburbs and urban design, and I published a Martha Stewart novel about a character like Martha. And then I wrote The Long Emergency, which was a book about the global oil predicament and its convergence with other things like climate change and the banking fiasco, and how these things were going to change our lives in a very severe way, and in not a whole lot of time. And that book did find an audience of people who were noticing the same things that I was. And after I did that, I wanted to write a novel to depict very vividly what this world of the post-petroleum and post-economic collapse America would look like. So I pursued it. I wrote World Made by Hand, and then 2 years later, I wrote a sequel because I was very interested in this world I was creating, and we were still heading in that direction, and I wanted to get further into it. And in fact, I decided that I wanted to write one book for each of the four seasons. So the first one, World Made by Hand, was a summer book, and The Witch of Hebron was the fall book, set, as it is, the week of Halloween. Same year, same town, same people.
Right. So are you going to keep on going?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to keep on going. I'm under contract to write a nonfiction book for the Atlantic Monthly Press, and it's going to be kind of how we're... You know, I do think it's a kind of an important message about the mistake we're making in our techno-rapture, in all of this wishing and fantasizing about running Walt Disney World and Walmart by other means than oil. There's a great deal of wishing that's going on right now that is going to trip us up, and we're going to be very disappointed about how these things work out, especially if we keep up this techno-grandiose, techno-triumphal rapture that we're in. But that's going to be kind of a down-and-dirty book, and then I'm going to get back to my people in the little fictional town of Union Grove, New York.
Well, I have to say, I mean, there are a lot of things I want to talk about, but one thing I do want to say as a reader, and I read fiction and nonfiction, I have serious interest in a lot of the topics that we're talking about, the future, but as novels, I think these are both really beautiful books.
Well, thank you very much. The reviewers never notice that my books are well written, and they also never notice that they're funny.
Well, not only are they funny, I mean, there's so many interesting things about them that your characters are sweet in many regards. I mean, you know, you've painted a kind of Jeffersonian portrait of this community, you know, in the midst of horror and pain and suffering, you know, as the future unfolds in the way you've imagined it, you know, which is, there's a lot of death and there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of challenge for the people who are in this community and other parts of the, obviously other parts of the world. But what you've created is this world that's very vivid and real. It's, you know, that's one of the reasons that I was so attracted to it. You know, you've got human beings and they are dealing with, you know, they're dealing with what they're faced with. And I guess in a certain way, there's a, you know, it's an interesting way, because we imagine the future, I mean, some people imagine the future as being, pretty dark, you know, and that you're not alone in thinking of, you know, the decline and fall through the dependence on oil. And it's been depicted in fiction by people like Cormac McCarthy, who's, you know, the road is about as dark as it gets.
Yeah, I'm a Cormac McCarthy fan, but, you know, we don't see eye to eye on the future. And, you know, I'm not putting out the same kind of, you know, dystopian picture that a lot of people mean when they even use the word dystopia. You know, the world that I'm depicting is actually a world that in many ways is healing itself from the insults of the industrial adventure.
Well, and I think it is a sort of a hopeful view rather than a completely hopeless.
You bet.
And you know, I think, you know, I'm very, you know, in some ways sympathetic to that. I think it's also that we want to believe, especially those of us who think that we are on the wrong path today and who despair sometimes of convincing enough of the people who are in a position to make change, that we can, you know, alter that future. It is also, you know, a kind of larger view that enables you to see that change is change. It's not, you know, things that happen may be painful and different than what we're used to, but not necessarily worse.
Well, I had a hidden agenda when I was writing this book, and that hidden agenda was to depict a world that actually had a lot of joys and comforts in it, as well as the losses that have been endured by the characters. And, you know, they're living in a world where they're no longer tyrannized by machines and engines. They're not sitting in cubicles working for faceless corporations that don't care about them, and which they don't care about. They are eating locally grown food that's not adulterated. They're making music with their neighbors. They're working shoulder to shoulder with their neighbors. They're living very locally and vividly in a planet that is, to some extent, recovering from the industrial era. You know, the air is purer. The water is recovering. They're living on the Hudson River and the Hudson River Valley. And so there are a lot of things going on. And, of course, you know, a lot of the normal kind of events and parameters of human life remain constant. You know, we are capable of finding joy. You know, people who are living in very different circumstances, either people who are very wealthy or people who are living in relative hardship, still find joy in everyday life. And I meant for people to understand that that would be there, and that people would still love each other, and that people would still be kind.
Right, and that you have, without being Pollyanna about it, also because you have, there are bad people.
Yeah, there are bad people, and they're complex though. They're not simple. They're not like Road Warrior cartoon characters.
Right. No, in fact, I thought, you know, especially in The Witch of Hebron, which is, you know, I read that second, so it's right in my mind right now. You know, the Billy the Bandit character is, you know, he's a great, complicated character, and you could see how he will become the basis of a legend told by, you know, by people about this character who, you know, sort of like Billy the Kid and, you know, other characters in our, in
yeah, he's a highwayman. He's a 19-year-old psychopath, but he's very charming. And in his way, I mean, you know, there are things about him that are obviously not too appetizing. But he's got some charm, at least insofar as his extreme self-consciousness of his own picturesque quality. You know, he's trying to become a legend. In fact, he states repeatedly that, you know, he's trying to instruct this 11-year-old boy who he's sort of holding in captivity. You know, maybe I better back up and say, you know, the Witch of Hebron book is about a character who was only a cameo in World Made by Hand. He's the 11-year-old son of the town doctor. And in The Witch of Hebron, he's at the center of the book. And his horse is stomped to death by a dog, and he poisons the horse, and he has to run away from home and run away from town and run away from everything that he knows. And he ends up in the company of this 19-year-old psychopathic bandit, Billy Bones, as he styles himself. And I did try to very, you know, very consciously to create a character who knew that he was a memorable character, even in the fictional world he inhabited.
Well, and of course, the story itself is a great takeoff on World Made by Hand, because you do have all the main characters and set up by, and I think people really need to read World Made by Hand first, which takes place in essentially the post collapse of, and I guess I want to ask you, where do you see, like, in just in terms of time?
Well, I was a little coy about that deliberately. You know, I didn't want to say this takes place in 2019 or 2023.
Right, but at least in your mind, you might have.
I thought it was about a decade or so into the future.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people who affect to prognosticate on world events, I tend to compress them. You know, that's one, I think, what people would call a weakness of mine. You know, I tend to compress the speed that these things occur in. One of the things that I've been impressed with since the publication of The Long Emergency, which was my nonfiction book about all this stuff, was how much inertia there is in this massive machine of modernity, and how it resists being destabilized even in the face of pretty intense forces of things going bad. You know, between the fiasco of the banking system and the global energy problem, you know, and just the perversity of geopolitical affairs, you know, it amazes me that really not a whole lot of consequence has occurred since 2001.
No, that's true, and I think that does, but it kind of shows us our own perspective on time.
Yeah.
That, you know, 10 years is a lot to us. It certainly is to me. But it's really just a whisper of a moment in the kind of historical sweep. And maybe it's sort of, you think of the collapse of the Soviet Union,
yeah.
You know, it was not a predicted event,
yeah.
At least by most people, that it would happen. And then it happened suddenly, as if out of nowhere. And I think that marks big system collapses, that they have inertia, they have, you know, people don't want to have big change. You know, left to their own devices, people like things the way they are.
Yeah, and I think that we really just done an amazing job around the world, but especially in the West and in America, in using an awful lot of gimmicks to cover up the fact that we're in trouble.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of this has basically been accounting fraud by banks and institutions. But it is amazing how effective it has been so far. It would probably be troublesome for me to say it's hard to imagine it going on that way a little, you know, that much longer. You know, especially now as we're speaking, and there's a kind of a very dangerous unwinding situation going on in Europe with the euro and the euro countries, and you know, it has every it gives every impression of being something that can't possibly keep going for another 3 weeks, and yet, you know, it keeps on rolling along. So, you know, it is amazing how we're doing that. But I think ultimately, you know, we are going to see these changes occur in a way that, let's say, the term phase change applies. You know, phase change is a term from physics. And what it means is that things are the same and things are the same and things are the same until suddenly they're not the same.
Right.
You know, like water is the same at 100 degrees and 97 degrees and 52 degrees, and then something happens at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's the same thing with landslides and avalanches. You know, when these things happen, they happen because of tipping points and phase change, and I think that's how it'll play out.
And so, you know, obviously there is the kind of sense of an imminent future in this book, because it's very recognizable. It isn't set in a far distant future like many, you know, some science fiction and fantasy is. It's really set in the world as we know it, and yet it has been upended. And I thought one of the key features in World Made by Hand is the realization that without electricity on a daily basis, a regular electricity, that every system basically that we live by will collapse. And of course, electricity is not something that you can literally take for granted, because it runs on oil or coal. and then it's
or natural gas or water. I mean, it does come, or nuclear. It comes from a lot of places, but you know, it's more like a matter of the electric grid is much more fragile than most Americans realize.
Well, and it can be threatened by you know, people. You know, if there's a as you have an epidemic or whatever it is that really deeply affects the society by, you know, I've thought about this because I read another book earlier this year that I talked about in another podcast called The Great Bay, which is a writer named Dale Pendel who lives in California, imagining his book is really a much longer sweep. He takes the whole world through thousands of years in a fairly short book. Yeah. But one of the key features is this idea that when systems collapse, people are not able to instantly remake their daily lives.
Yeah.
Because we've lost the ability. We don't have the means at hand. And what you have in your book, of course, is people emerge who have either learned or who have retained skills that enable them to survive in a world made by hand.
Yeah. You know, there were a lot of complaints when The World Made by Hand came out that I didn't depict all these people riding bicycles merrily about. And when I started to write that book, I realized within the first 10 pages or so, and it came in the form of really kind of a revelation, that these people could not possibly be riding bicycles around. They couldn't get the metal alloys for the replacement parts. They couldn't get rubber for the tires. You know, the pavements were all busted up and from neglect and just not being maintained over a rather short span of years. And I know that happens. Because when I wrote my books about suburbia, I interviewed a lot of traffic engineers back in those days. And all of them pretty consistently made the point that if you don't keep the highway system in immaculate condition, it deteriorates very quickly. So, I put those things together and realized, oh, these people aren't riding bicycles. Forget it. You know, they're going to be riding horses if they're riding anything. They are living in a period when cars are not running anymore, and I mention maybe two or three times in both books that an event has taken place called the Great Collection, and this is a collection of metal and metal parts, which we're given to understood were used in helping to prosecute a war in the Holy Land.
Right.
That has taken place.
Right. That's always lurking in the background. That was a kind of trigger event. It sounds like, at least as you have imagined it.
Yeah, I left things very, very sketchy. I it was my intention to have the readers connect the dots themselves and provide them with a few dots to do it with. But I really wanted to avoid being didactic and say, this is how the world is going to be, A, B, C, D, E, F. And, you know, I alluded to events and misfortunes that had occurred. But I didn't go on and on about them.
Well, I think it's better if, you know, in fiction there's a certain amount of power that it enables you to have if you're creating an imaginary place or space for people to enter. They engage in that world. And I think if you're thoughtful, then it's much, for some people, I think it's more influential to imagine it this way than it is to be told how it's going to happen.
Oh, I'm convinced that writing a novel is really writing a set of instructions for someone to run a movie in their head. And, you can be more or less skillful about it, and there are ways you can go about it that are better or different. But that's really sort of what it is about. But you have to leave room for that process to happen. You have to let the people run the movie in their own heads.
Right. Well, I think it's really a testament to your abilities because, if you've written a lot of nonfiction, which is much more of a telling and show than a showing.
Yeah, but I have published something like 11 novels.
Oh, okay.
Many people aren't aware of it. I had a kind of previous incarnation. I started out as a journalist in the 70s, actually the early 70s, and I dropped out, and I wrote novels for about 10 years, and they all got published by major publishers, you know, St. Martin's Press and Norton and Simon & Schuster and Doubleday, but none of them were hits. And it was kind of a long apprenticeship. In fact, I was still waiting on tables after my eighth novel came out in 1988 or so. So, you know, and it was after that that I felt a little burnt out writing novels that weren't you know, making me a whole lot of money. So I sort of shifted gears back to journalism, and that's what led me to write 4 books about, you know, towns, cities, suburbs, and that stuff.
So have you, oh, I mean, you live now, I think, in the Hudson River Valley.
I live in Saratoga Springs, which is 10 miles from the Hudson River, but pretty much officially in the upper part of the Hudson River Valley. It's kind of the entrance, the gateway to the Adirondack Mountains. But it's also, you know, the upper Hudson is a very special place. The novel itself is set in Washington County, which is on the eastern bank of the Hudson from Saratoga. And it's the county that borders on Vermont.
Right.
So it's between the Hudson River and Vermont.
And with Bennington would be due east.
Pretty much, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Bennington and Manchester.
Right.
And so it's a hilly country. It's kind of the prelude to the Green Mountains. It's far enough away from New York City and Boston so that there haven't really been any huge developments of weekenders up there. It's still pretty much farms or property that was farms up until, you know, 10 years ago when the dairying industry kind of crapped out. And it's got several very sweet little small towns that are kind of decrepit. They've kind of lost their economies, but they're hanging in there. You know, some of them look like Soviet backwater towns at
so,
this point.
And,
but
as you envision the future, and I guess, you know, this is probably visible in these books, but maybe we could talk about that a little. Do you see places like that, or, you know, maybe northern New Hampshire, Maine, the places, at least in the east, that have been maybe depopulated and become more neglected as being more likely to survive the upheavals because people there are better able to adapt?
Well, it's funny because I'm about to write a chapter about the cities of the future for my next book. And my view of how people are going to live, how they're going to inhabit the landscape, is rather different from a lot of conventional thinking right now. You know, a lot of conventional thinking would say, for example, that if the suburbs fail, then everybody will move to the cities. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think that our big metroplex cities are going to have tremendous problems of their own associated with their scale and the fact that they're not scaled to the energy or capital realities of the future. That is, our problems with money and with fuel. And I think they're going to contract a lot, and some of them are going to go out of business. You know, places like Phoenix and Las Vegas will dry up and blow away, but
right. They're
all going to get into a lot of trouble. I think that we're going to see a return to places, A, that exist in some meaningful relationship to local agriculture, and B, have an infrastructure of civic equipment that is scaled to the energy realities of the future. And I think we're going to see a lot of America's small cities become inhabited and reactivated. You know, places like Utica, New York, and Hudson Falls, you know, the small towns of the upper Midwest. And I think that our smaller, you know, agricultural centers, agricultural towns, and that's what a lot of the ones around here used to be. They were trading centers for farming economies. And I think that they will become that again as agriculture becomes quite a bit more central to our economic life than it has been for a long, long time. You know, the things that are central now, finance, entertainment, transportation, tourism, these things are going to fade into the, you know, perhaps even fade out altogether. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of tourism in the future. And I think that as these things contract, local agriculture is going to become much more prominent in our daily life.
Well, it makes sense. And, I, you know, clearly the cities, if you imagine, you know, and especially if you look at the past, you know, past history of human civilization, where cities have been able to form because of surpluses in agriculture and in labor, you know, they collapse at a certain point. We often have not been able to figure out why they collapse. I think the inference is they collapse because the systems no longer support the structure.
Yeah, I think that Joseph Tainter got it pretty right in his book about the collapse of complex societies, which is really one of the seminal works of our time. And, you know, basically what we're dealing with is a range of hyper-complexity that is producing huge diminishing returns for us. In other words, the more complex we make stuff now, the worse it works for us. You know, and you can see this in things as simple as the fact that your television remote is now so complicated that you have to call up Time Warner Cable to come over and program it for you. They have to actually send the guy over to program it. Or the fact that, you know, we spent 30 years and, let's say, $20 billion computerizing the phone system in America, and the net result is you can't get a live human being on the phone anymore.
Right, which is, you know, another way of describing the massive alienation of humans from physical work.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because I think that Americans, to some extent, a lot of Americans are pretty sore beset by working harder than they've ever worked for less than they've gotten in a long time.
Well, that's true, but it's the nature of the work. It's, you know, you go into an office, you know, you try to figure out what are people doing.
Yeah.
People have to work like crazy because of the desire to connect to all of these things that they've been convinced they need.
Yeah.
You know, we all suffer from, you know, an overabundance of things, and that, you know, and if you want to have the entertainment as you described, or the computer that you have to have, the cell phone, all of those things, that's what you end up working for.
You know, I was in the local supermarket the other night, and we do have supermarkets up here. This is a civilized corner of the USA. And I overheard a conversation between two employees, you know, two kind of, stock people. And this woman said to her friend, I got to go home to a cold house. And her friend said, well, why don't you turn the heat up? And she said, well, we can't run the heat. We don't have any money. And I just thought, you know, God almighty, how many people are going through that out there? And these are people who are working. And these are people who are working hard, long hours, at times of day that aren't that attractive to be working. And it just made me feel so sorry for what is happening to these people. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm warm. But there are an awful lot of people right now, as we're speaking, and heading into the Christmas season of 2010, who have these fundamental problems. You know, they can't heat their homes. They can't feed their families. They have no idea how they're going to pay their next electric bill. And, you know, it's really something out there.
Oh, that's true. And there doesn't seem to be a good, common, usable analysis of both why that happens and how it could be remedied.
Well, the lack of compassion in our system at the moment, as evidenced by the fact that these calamities that people are facing are not even in the public discourse. They're not even on the news. You know, there's more news about Kim Kardashian than there is about people freezing their ass off in Michigan, you know?
That's true.
And it's just amazing. And, I don't think that the American people are evil. I don't even think that the people at CNN are evil. But, you know, it's a stunning illustration of how disconnected we are from reality. And unfortunately, you know, as societies get into deeper distress, the delusional thinking tends to increase. And, you know, I think we're going to see more and more of that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of Kim Kardashian and less of the hardships that Americans are facing, even as they get harder.
Right. Well, maybe it's not willful. I tend to think of it sometimes as being, you know, sort of designed into the system to distract people from other things that would, you know, enable them to challenge accepted reality.
I don't think the executives of CNN or NBC or even Fox, you know, as mendacious as they are, you know, I don't see them as, you know, sitting around rubbing their hands plotting to deprive America of knowledge of what's going on. You know, a lot of this is very willful on the part of the American public. The American public is not paying attention. You know, there's an old aphorism that people don't get what they expect, but they get what they deserve
mm-hmm.
in politics and social relations and history. And, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing that. And I do a lot of lecturing in front of college audiences and, you know, even conferences and things. And I constantly have to remind audiences, you know, who ask me questions that sort of challenge the idea that I'm not sufficiently idealistic, you know, that I have to remind them that life is tragic. And by that, I don't mean that everything, every outcome is bad. You know, what I mean is that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end of everything. And that's the center of the human condition. And also that, you know, people have to live with the consequences of their choices, including societies, collectively. So we're making a lot of really bad choices, collectively, and we are failing to construct a coherent consensus about what's going on and about what we're going to do about it. And, you know, and unfortunately life is tragic and we have to live with the consequences of all.
So, and I guess that is my key question that may be the last question I'll ask you. Do you think, in the face of what you just said, because I think I tend to agree with you, do you feel, though, that means that the outcome is somewhat predictable, or do you think that there will be, you know, a wake-up at some point, and can we wake up in time?
I think history is having its way with us. I think that events are not in the hands of personalities anymore, but of circumstances that are bearing down on us. It doesn't mean that I think that we're impotent or that, you know, we can't make choices. But you know, every week that goes by that we continue to do what we're doing, we're putting ourselves in more jeopardy. And by that I mean, what we're doing is, you know, we've ramped up a campaign to sustain the unsustainable. That's what's going on in America. We're doing everything we can to persuade ourselves that we can run Walmart, Walt Disney World, and the interstate highway system by some other way without either a really good energy supply or the necessary capital to run it with. And those are the two things that are bearing down on us at the moment. A shortage of capital, that's what the banking catastrophe is all about, and a developing oil fiasco. And I think that those events are now, you know, events are now in charge, not people.
Do you feel the same way about the climate change, that essentially, you know, because of the, you know, the lag time in climactic events, that, you know, we've gone past the tipping point?
I really don't know, although I'm not a climate change denier at all. I think that it's really going on. But I do think that there are enough kind of nonlinear things going on that it's very hard to predict. For example, you know, it's been predicted that Europe is going to have, parts of Europe will have the coldest winter in 500 years. And I actually wrote about this in The Long Emergency, that the possibility that the Gulf Stream would be affected by melting polar ice caps.
Yeah,
that, you know, the equation between fresh water and saline water would change the way the Gulf Stream works. And that appears to be going on now, but, you know, there are all kinds of unpredictable things. I would cut to the chase, though, and say I think that the most impactful consequences of climate change in the short to medium term are going to be food shortages. And that's already expressing itself in the droughts that are occurring in some of the grain-producing areas of the world. I was just in Western Australia about 10 days ago, and they have a terrible drought in what used to be the wheat belt of southwest Australia, near Perth. Russia has had a terrible drought, and they had a very bad year for producing wheat. And a lot of their wheat gets exported to West Africa. And so the Africans are going to suffer because of the drought in Russia. The grains grown in Australia generally go to the Middle East and to China. They're going to get less of that. Commodity prices are going up as a result of all this. You know, it's food's getting a lot more expensive. So I think it's going to express itself that way first before people turn around and say, oh, yeah, climate change, this seems to be happening.
Right.
They'll just say, oh, there's no food in the supermarket. What's up with that?
Well, it's a pretty there are so many things to be worried about. It is sometimes daunting.
But I'm a cheerful guy. I want to reinforce that idea, because I'm not sitting here wringing my hands. And I do think that one of the big things that we got to watch out for in the weeks and months ahead and years ahead is that we can't afford to be crybabies. We got too much to do. You know, we got a long to-do list of things we got to fix if we're going to keep on keeping on. And we can't afford to be crybabies about anything.
I think that's a really good message. And I think it's probably a good place for us to stop. I really appreciate your spending some time. It's been great talking to you.
Well, David, it's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
And this has been Writer's Cast. This is a podcast about books and authors. I've had the great pleasure of talking to James Howard Kunstler about two of his books, World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron, which is the sequel to World Made by Hand. And I'd really recommend that these are books people go out and buy. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, David.